8 to 9 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial.
And you're listening to WBAI New York. Stay tuned for Living for the City coming right up.
And welcome to Living for the City. Living for the City is a program focusing on telling stories, our histories, our perspectives of local communities throughout our area and beyond. If you have lived in New York City for any length of time, you know how difficult it is to get the media to report about a subject in depth, tell the truth, or even cover an issue. We examine those very issues, especially dealing with the real estate industry and the very powerful lobbyists. We look at housing, land, air, and water use, including sunlight, and we do so truthfully, accurately, without any conflicts of interest. My name is Michael G. Haskins. I'm the program host and executive producer of the show. And the senior producer is Jillian Jonas. Before I go further and introduce my guests, I want to familiarize you with the concept of Sankofa. Sankofa is a word in the Akan Twi and Fante languages of Ghana that translates to retrieve, literally go back and get. Just like the Sankofa bird that is looking back over its shoulder to see where it has come from, we look back in history to see where we've come from. To help us understand how we come to exist in this current moment and help us chart a course for the future. And on this day, in peace and social justice history, April 6, 1712, the first major slave rebellion in the North American British colonies took place in New York City. One out of every five New Yorkers was enslaved at the time. 23 black slaves set fire to buildings, killed six white British subjects, and wounded six others. Also on this date, in 1909, Robert Perry, his Negro servant, Matthew Henson, and four Eskimos reached the geographic North Pole for the first time. Though Henson was alongside Perry, widely hailed as a courageous explorer during that and subsequent Arctic expeditions, Henson achieved little notice until much later in life. In 1968, on this date, dozens of major cities in the United States experienced an escalation of rioting in reaction to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. 2 days before. At least 19 people had already died in the arson and shootings. Several hundred had also been injured and about 3,000 arrested, most of those in Washington, D.C. In 1968, on this date, Bobby Hutton, the 17-year-old first member of the Black Panther Party, was gunned down by officers of the Oakland Police Department. Police opened fire on a car of Black Panthers returning from a meeting. The Panthers escaped their vehicle and ran into a house. Police attacked the house with tear gas and gunfire. After the building was on fire, the Panthers tried to surrender. Hutton came out of the house with his hands in the air, but a police officer shouted, quote, "He's got a gun," unquote. This prompted further police gunfire that left Hutton dead and Panthers co-founder Eldridge Cleaver wounded. Police later admitted that Hutton was unarmed. And finally, on this day in peace and social justice history, April 6, 1996, 11 were arrested at the main post office near Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., for attempting to mail medical supplies to Iraq in defiance of the U.S.-led embargo. Between 1990 and 1995, with the first Gulf War and the sanctions regime imposed by the U.S., its coalition, and the U.N., infant and under five mortality rates in Iraq had more than doubled. This is Living for the City over WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. I'm Michael G. Haskins. We'll be right back. Tune to 99.5 FM WBAI. This is Living for the City, WBAI.org on the web. And thank you all so very much for tuning in today. This is a listener-sponsored commercial-free radio station on the air since 1960. That's 62 years of commercial-free broadcasting, thanks to listeners just like you. Well, I'd like to bring on my first guest. Now, did the city ignore its own environmental laws, as well as others, when it aggressively pushed for the Gowanus rezoning at the end of the de Blasio administration, shepherded by former council members Steve Levine and now comptroller Brad Lander? While this is not a new question, rezoning opponents filed a lawsuit against the city just last month for violating both environmental and preservation laws. With me to discuss the community lawsuit is someone with whom our listeners should be familiar, sustainability and environmental consultant Maureen Coates, who is co-counsel for the plaintiffs. Maureen Coates, welcome back.
Michael, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Maureen. Well, all right. What are the basic arguments made in the lawsuit against the Gowanus rezoning? Let's start there.
The primary focus of this lawsuit is that the rezoning process did not follow the State Environmental Quality Review Act, and it also violated several provisions of the federal National Environmental Policy Act. And as I'm sure your listeners know, both of those statutes, the state and the federal law, require the preparation of a legally compliant environmental impact statement. And that was definitely not done in this case.
They were inadequate, to say.
Totally inadequate. They failed to evaluate several overlapping, what I like to call geocapital, air, land, and water asset issues mm-hmm. that are present in the Gowanus at a very intense level. As we know, the Gowanus is a Superfund site,
yes.
which means there is a vast amount of historic contamination in the canal bed, and along the shoreline and the areas around the canal, as well as in the groundwater around the canal. In addition, the canal has been a repository for combined sewer overflow for decades. Mm-hmm. The Red Hook wastewater treatment plant, which serves the area, was one of the last wastewater treatment plants to even be built. And up until the late 1980s, when it came into service, raw sewage was constantly being dumped in the Gowanus Canal all day, every day. Now there is sewage release constantly in rain events, when the rainwater mixes with the sanitary sewage coming from homes and businesses, and it's too much for the system to take, and the overflow discards into the canal. So the city has been in violation of the Clean Water Act for many decades on these combined sewer overflow violations. It's a Superfund site. There's an enormous amount of toxic material that has not been cleaned up. And then on top of it, most of these issues were inadequately disclosed, portrayed, inadequate information, data was provided, and therefore the environmental impact statement was totally inadequate to support the decision to rezone 80 blocks.
Wow, I'm just coming to grips with everything you just said. It is thinking about the community in and of itself and all that what you just said entails. There still are inadequate cleanup, and there are other environmental failures that I'm sure we could spend the rest of the program talking about it. But I'd like to move on here. Now, the chief environmental attorney handling the case,
Richard Lippis.
He has a long history of litigating environmental disasters like Three Mile Island and Love Canal. Many of us are old enough to remember Love Canal, yet he called the Gowanus rezoning, quote, an exceptionally egregious set of failures to comply with the law, unquote. That's a stunning description from someone who really should know, who does know.
It is. Well, some of the violations are not subtle, Michael. You know, it's not as if there were 10 years of data and we're arguing there should have been 12 or something, and kind of nuanced or marginal like that. The city, for example, absolutely failed to issue a findings statement, which is non-negotiable under the law. You have to issue a finding statement, and you have to state all of the mitigating or controlling measures you're going to put in place. They did not give adequate data about the CSOs. EPA, the federal EPA Region 2 experts, provided comments indicating the EIS was inadequate. But this goes to the larger problem, Michael, that your program and others have tried so hard to keep illuminating, and thank you for it. The city uses various public policy activities like a Trojan horse. So affordable housing has become the Trojan horse to allow thousands of gentrifying apartments to go into areas that can't sustain that level of development. The city uses environmental justice as a Trojan horse, especially in the case of Gowanus, when they're attempting to suggest they're rectifying some kind of historic injustice. In fact, they're perpetrating an even worse one. And bringing up Love Canal is so important because there, Hooker Chemical Company had told a school district that an area was contaminated and it really wasn't suitable for the kind of development the locality was planning, the municipality, and they did it anyway. And we have something so terribly similar here, where the manufactured gas plant sites, which we know to be thoroughly toxic, and we know to be what they call operable units of the canal Superfund site. In other words, that's one of the sources where there's residual toxicity that's leaking into the canal water. They know that's there, and yet they're still planning to put affordable housing on those parcels. And how can you possibly pick the contaminated sites for the affordable housing while you let massive 30-story high-end luxury apartment towers be built in the rest of the area and say this is all about rectifying environmental injustice? The mind just sometimes can't take the twistedness of it all.
Yes, and I'm so glad we were able to work in together and allow people to understand, and those who don't understand or are unfamiliar with Love Canal, I encourage them to look it up, and you did a really fantastic connection between the two, because, you know, what happened all of those decades ago is now coming back. We're revisiting that yet again, and who knows what will be the outcome of that illness and sickness, probably.
And if I could just make one more quick point, Michael, you know, Love Canal broke in the mid to late 70s, and then the Superfund Law, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation Liability Act, was passed in 1980. New York City did not disclose and identify its Superfund sites until 2010. The Gowanus and the Newtown Creek went on the Superfund, finally. And Coney Island Creek should be listed. They have scored their hazard levels score to be on the National Priorities List, as it's called, and EPA hasn't listed it. And another site in Greenpoint only just got listed, and there's another site in Brooklyn with radioactivity. So New York City has really been way behind the curve in owning up to its legacy toxicity. And failing to disclose that, I guess, of course, you know, because we think it will impede development. But we just need to do a better job of coming to grips with how much residual contamination remains in New York City.
Well, I know we touched on this at the beginning, at the outset, we talked about the rezoning and the elements of it, the worst elements of it. Just flesh that out anymore, if there's more to say about the sewage controls, the brownfield site location of affordable houses. Touch on that a little bit more before we go on.
Sure. Well, in addition to the overloads to both the Owl's Head and the Red Hook sewage sheds, if you will, remember, downtown Brooklyn was supposed to have 4,000 residential units. It developed about 12,000. There is also the development out by Atlantic Yards. Governor's Island is going to be developed. All of those sewage hookups have to go into the Red Hook system, and then there's a whole set going into Owl's Head. So these systems are already stressed. There's already more sanitary sewage and rainwater and stormwater going into them than they can take, and there is just tragically no more clear evidence of how inadequate New York City's sewage system is that it recently killed people. I mean, when people are dying because we cannot take care of sewage and stormwater in a rain event, we know we just can't walk away from this anymore or fail to understand it. And on top of that, the Gowanus is a flood zone. So Michael, if you can picture that water is going to either come down from the sky, you've got storm water, you've got sewage, you've got seawater, you know, just tides and those sorts of things and sea level rise. and then you've got surges. So in all of those ways, water is intruding into that area on a regular basis. And it makes sense. It used to be a salt marsh. It was really not intended to be the site of 30-story buildings. And so you have the basic issues as well of handling both the stormwater and the sewage in conjunction with sea level rise and storm surges that are now more prevalent because of climate change. None of that was adequately evaluated in the EIS either. And in fact, the idea that most of the large buildings are going to be as close to the canal as they will, it boggles the mind how this level of construction is going to go down into an area that's saturated with water, prone to flooding. And our biggest concerns are now with large buildings in the way, if you will, of the current drainage patterns, and they will all build themselves to have lower level controls. That means floodwater will be pushed around them and go up into the areas least able to handle it, like the Gowanus houses and other areas with people's basements and affordable housing that already exists. So the city just will not come to grips with how it's got to manage water in conjunction with land. And then on top of that, you have all the extra traffic and cars and congestion and air pollution and greenhouse gases. All of these buildings are going to use gas heat and hot water and cooking. So they will all be front-loaded with gas at a time when New York City keeps suggesting you're going to lower gas use and gas requirements. So the Gowanus is nothing. It's just this one contradiction of purported city policy after another. Whatever comes out of one side of the former de Blasio administration's ideas comes out of one side of their mouth. The Gowanus is nothing but everything coming out of the other side of their mouth in terms of climate change policy, air pollution, water control, all of it.
It certainly does seem that way. Maureen Coates is my guest today on Living for the City, Planet A Strategies Managing Director, Sustainability Executive and Consultant. This is Living for the City over WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm Michael G. Haskins. Maureen, you also maintain the city's failures to conduct a proper EIS are applicable in general across New York. How so? And is it just regarding other upzonings only?
If I could take a minute to sort of talk a little bit about the fundamental systemics. I mean, we've traditionally always said land use planning, but in fact, in order to use land, you also have to use water and air. And while land can be privately acquired, you can buy and sell land, most water and air assets belong to the public. They are effectively public trust assets. So in order for development or enterprise systems to succeed, once they get hold of land and then they want to build a building up into the air and run water through it, most of the time, those proposals have got to get their hands on public air and water. And in order to do that, they can't really tell the truth about the quantities they're going to actually use because those air and water supplies are controlled by the federal government. That's what the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act did, even though sometimes the authority to implement or oversee is delegated back to the state. So the city doesn't really own a lot of the air and the water that it's appropriating and expropriating to private sector entities. So that's why EISs rarely give you accurate information as to just how much consumption and use and potentially degradation and harm are going to occur. I mean, if the city actually told the truth about the levels of sewage and stormwater, they'd be admitting to further violations of the Clean Water Act. So you have that going on all the time. This is just a way of making sure that you have inadequate analysis so that nobody realizes how much you're picking the pocket of the public trust. And that's a huge issue. Mm-hmm. And so these EISs have been inadequate for a very long time. I mean, we talked about Two Bridges on a previous show. That EIS was inadequate. But there's a more insidious pattern that we're noticing, Michael, and that is rather than do an appropriate EIS, the city and the development entities go to the community first, and they try to get the community to trade away these assets in what these sort of side deals, if you will. I'll fix the elevator in the subway station, and you'll let me have the open space, or you'll let me have two more floors on a building, or three more floors, or five more floors, which uses up more air and more light. And the Gowanus has got one of the most insidious of these kinds of agreements. They're totally ultra vires. Brad Lander signs an agreement he has no authority to sign. The people in the Gowanus houses were promised $200 million to restore those houses. The city doesn't have that money. It's not in a budget line. The people authorized to spend it are not parties to the agreement. It's one of the most outrageous acts of malfeasance I've seen in a long time, to promise a community a whole series of things you have absolutely no authority to deliver, and no money.
And no money. Yes.
So that's why these EISs are so problematic, because, if you look at the history of the Gowanus, the bridging Gowanus exercises where community people were brought in, and they said, would you like a school? Okay, well, if you let us put three more floors on top of the buildings, you can have school. Oh, would you like a this? Would you like a that? I mean, they made these people believe that these kinds of trades, they could just buy them off. Millions and millions of dollars worth of FAR and airspace and those sorts of things were traded on the come for something that may or may not be delivered. And that is just the worst kind of, I'm not sure what it is. It's part bribery, it's part extortion, it's part fraud, it's just all terrible.
Maureen, we're just about out of time, but in the last couple of minutes we have, I just want to try to squeeze this in. Yesterday, the WHO World Health Organization released a report saying 99% of the world's population breathes poor quality air. Could you speak to that before I ask you for some contact information, please?
Sure. Happily, in the United States, we have taken significant steps over the last several decades to alleviate a good deal of what was horrendous air quality in this country for a long time. But there are still major areas, like in cities that are near various kinds of industrial enterprise systems, that are still breathing poor quality air, and certainly people near the roads and transit lines. The non-electric transit lines are suffering from that continued air pollution. And that's one of the most important things that also has to be examined in these EISs. New York City has not reduced its greenhouse gas levels at all. And no matter what you hear about and how many Plan YCs and 1YC and how much chatterboxing is done, the emission levels are not down. And New York remains in non-attainment. That's a Clean Air Act word for saying that there's more pollution loading into the air than the standards of the statute allow. So while there has been some improvement, particularly in America, it's not done yet. And in the rest of the world, the situation is terrible, particularly particulate matter. There's still an enormous amount of fossil fuel use. There's still vehicular not clean vehicles. So, yes, we've got a long way to go.
Long way to go. Give us some contact information, Maureen Coates. What can listeners do, et cetera?
Well, I would encourage all listeners to support your local community organization. The Voice of Gowanus is a marvelous group of just average citizens banding together to try to stop this juggernaut of rezoning that Mayor de Blasio unleashed. Well, certainly Mayor Bloomberg did quite a bit of it, too. You can go to the Voice of Gowanus website, and if you're so inclined, please make a donation. They're working hard to afford the attorney in this case, who of course, is very much helping out on a public benefit, but we all still have to keep the lights on.
Yeah.
And Planet A Strategies has a website as well, planetastrategies.com. And I can be reached at coates@planetastrategies if anybody would like to ask a question. And like I say, support your local community organization. MTOP, Planet A Strategies, Inwood Community. There are just so many organizations. Low East Side Organized Neighbors.
They're all out there doing the hard work. All of whom have been on this program. Thanks again to Jillian Jonas. Thanks to this space for being here, WBAI. As we say goodbye, and thank you very much, Marie. I don't know whether you know this or not, but we did a promo for the program using part of the audio of one of our conversations before. Yes, we did. Now, I have to ask you, it's a little bit inside baseball, but I want to know, because I don't know. Who is Cabussier? Because you used that. You talked about that in terms of life. Who is Cabussier?
He was a French member of the Bauhaus School. And you may have heard of that. It was a German sort of art and architecture movement. It was about a lot of simplification and eliminating of decoration. But Corbusier was an advocate of what they called at the time the Tower in the Park architecture theme, where instead of being cramped in small buildings, remember, we're only just coming out of the tenement era.
Yes, that's correct.
In cities like New York and Paris had that, and certainly London, many large cities had, hovels and bobbles and any number of phrasing used around the world to describe the same problem. People cramped in tiny little buildings with very little light and no windows and no circulation. So Corbusier created the idea of a tower where the building was in a form of kind of an X, which meant that every floor and set of apartments that protruded out had windows in every room. And this was, this was glorious. We've come to learn what some of the downsides of that style can be, certainly, and I don't doubt what it's created. But at the time when New York first started using public housing designs of that nature, so many people were able to get air and light and circulation and be, have trees around their houses. And
so important.
And it was innovative, and it was very positive for health at the time.
Okay. Well, we may use another excerpt from our conversation today for another promo for Living
for
the
City. Well, it's huge. Just quickly, Michael, what always stuns me is if we're going to take the light away from a statue or a stained glass window, we think that's a problem. But if we're going to block the light on an 8-year-old child studying their books in the window of their room, no probs. Our notions of where shadows can and can't go is totally out of whack, as far as I'm concerned.
Maureen,
and forgets our history.
In the introduction, I say every week we look at housing, land, air, and water use, including sunlight. Including sunlight.
Exactly.
Marie Coates, thank you so much. We are flat out of time today, but we will certainly have you back as we continue to look at what is going on, what is developing, what is evolving over there in Gowanus. Marie Coates, thank you so much for being here today. All right, so that's Maureen Coates.
I'm Jacqueline Murekatete, a Rwandan genocide survivor and activist, and you're listening to WBAI. My name is Jacqueline Murekatete, a Rwandan genocide survivor and activist, and you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York City. Nitwa Jacqueline Murekatete ndo muri escape ya genocide y'abatutsi yabaye muri 1994 mu Rwanda. Murimo kumva WBAI at 99.5 FM hano mu mujyi wa New York.
That is the station ID done for us in English and the Rwandan language, and that is the nimbleness and being adept to the situation right at hand of an engineer, Paul DiRienzo. Thank you so much for catching it and bringing that back to us. This is listener-sponsored, commercial-free, Radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Michael G. Haskins, program host. As I said at the outset of the program, we are a commercial-free and listener-sponsored radio station. We have been on the air for 62 years. Sisters and brothers, 62 years without commercial interruption. The entire conversation that I had with Maureen Coates of Planet A Strategies, the managing director of sustainability executive and consultant, was without commercial intervention at all. We're able to bring that to you and that discussion looking way back in our history, as you know, Sankofa is always part of the program, but way back in history to Love Canal and how the connections bring it right to what's going on today in Gowanus. Well, we're able to do that because we're commercially free. Take a moment, please, and consider becoming a sustaining member of this radio station by calling our pledge line right now at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Become a sustaining member, become a first-time subscriber to the radio station. Become a member at $25, you can do that. Or if you could pledge more than that, if you could pledge at the $100 level, the $500 level, whatever is comfortable for you. If you think this program is important beyond the program itself, the station itself, and having programs like What's Going On in the Morning, Democracy Now, and the myriad programs that are with 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, call the pledge line right now at 212-209-2950. Our friends in Suffolk County, in Putnam County, in Orange County, in New York State, that's just part of it. That is just part of our listening area, 60 to 90 miles in all directions. Down in Monmouth County, Middlesex County, Essex, and Bergen counties in New Jersey, and I haven't even gotten to Connecticut yet. Listener-sponsored WBAI. It's part of our terrestrial signal area, and through WBAI.org, it is enormous. It is worldwide. Thank you so very much. 212-209-2950. Well, our next guest is an adjunct professor at Columbia University, where he teaches journalism, and at John Jay College, where he teaches African history. He's also publisher of Black Star News and host of Black Star News Show here on WBAI every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Welcome, Milton.
Hey, comrade. Thank you so much for hosting me once again. Memories come back.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Listeners who may not know, back in, was it 2015, when I used to host the morning show 6 to 8 a.m., Milton Alamadi was my regular guest on Tuesdays at 7 a.m. So I'm really happy to share some time with him again. Milton, our attention, the world actually, it certainly is, the world is looking at the war in Ukraine. Many of us are noticing, the difference in treatment of African refugees as well as Jamaican nationals fleeing the war-ravaged land. As always, Milton, looking back in history, particularly to April 7th, now today is the 6th, but to April 7th, 1994, when the genocide in Rwanda began, I feel is very important. I won't be on the air tomorrow, but I want to reflect nonetheless on that significant day. Milton, how should we view what happened in Rwanda at the end of the 20th century?
We should view that as the reinforcement of the notion that black lives really, you know, don't matter. That was the ultimate manifestation. The calamity that occurred in Rwanda was the culmination of an imperial partnership between U.S. imperialism in Africa, partnered with an African imperialist who is General Yoweri Museveni, the Ugandan dictator. You know, the part of the story that unfortunately is not told is that Rwanda was invaded from Uganda in 1990, October 1, 1990. And that invasion exacerbated ethnic tension and animosity between the Hutu majority population and the Tutsi ethnic minority population, who comprised about 15% of the population. And this dated back to when the Hutu majority took power in the early 1960s. The Tutsi had been the ruling elite when the country was had been a monarchy, superimposing on top of that monarchy was Belgian colonialism. Mm. So when the majority population came to power, there were massacres of the minority Tutsi, and many fled to neighboring countries, including Uganda. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when General Museveni fought to win power in Uganda in 1986, he was helped by many of the sons and daughters of these refugees who had grown up in Uganda. And he had promised to aid them in invading Rwanda to go back to their country. So that invasion was ignored when it happened in 1990, but that's really what began to set up what then led to the plane, the presidential plane, being shot down on April 6, 1994, carrying the president of Rwanda and president of neighboring Burundi, president of Rwanda, Habyarimana. And when that plane was shot down, that then set off or sparked off the genocidal massacres that we witnessed. Now, unfortunately, as you know, corporate media has this tendency to present narratives as good guys versus bad guys. Right. So in that situation, Paul Kagame, who had been trained, by the way, by the United States at the Fort Leavenworth Military Academy, and he had become the leader of the Rwanda Patriotic Front. So he and his fighters became the good guys, and all the Hutus, you know, including the civilians, were portrayed as the bad guys. And Kagame was then portrayed as the person who stopped the genocide and lauded as a hero. But the story is a bit more complex, and obviously we don't have time to go into the details, but I strongly recommend for anybody interested to watch a documentary called Rwanda's Untold Story. That documentary was produced by the BBC. It's not been shown in the United States for political reasons, because that documentary outlines that, in fact, there were no good guys in the Rwanda calamity. The documentary, according to Kagame's closest aides, his former chief of military staff and his former ambassador to the United States, alleged that he was the one that ordered the plane to be shot down. Now, what motive would he have to do that? And here is the alleged motive. Prior to the plane being shot down, there had been the neighboring countries had forced the parties to negotiate a settlement, and they had signed a peace accord in Arusha, in Tanzania. that peace accord called for one man, one vote democratic elections. And allegedly, Kagame knew that he, being part of the ethnic minority Tutsi, would not be able to win power by elections. Mm-hmm. And his only recourse was to seize power by military means. So allegedly, he knew that if that plane was shot down, it would spark genocidal killings. He then would rush in and seize power and say, I am the one that stopped these massacres. And even though he would belong to the ethnic minority population, by virtue of stopping those horrific killings, the world would then tolerate him mm-hmm. ruling that country. And that is the narrative that is also outlined in that documentary by the BBC, which, of course, was attacked by the Rwanda government. Because anybody that challenges the narrative that Kagame did not play any agency in the genocide itself, but was the savior, anybody that challenges that narrative, who says that, in fact, both Hutu and Tutsis were victims of this imperial war launched from Uganda in 1990 by the Ugandan U.S. puppet Museveni, anybody that challenges the standard narrative is then accused of being a genocide denier. And that has been the problem of getting the other side of this calamity, the story out that I've just outlined.
So again, that is Rwanda's untold story. It is produced by the BBC?
Correct. In 2014, and people who want to see it can actually Google that name, and it will take you to Venmo, and you can see that entire compelling documentary, which is about, it's less than an hour, about 50 minutes or so. And of course, the BBC was also accused by the Rwanda government of being genocide deniers, not surprisingly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm speaking with adjunct professor at Columbia University, Milton Alamadi. He's also a John Jay College. He teaches journalism at Columbia. He's also at John Jay College, where he teaches African history. This is Living for the City. Milton, we're just about done with our conversation today. I have some fundraising responsibilities, as you very well know. Let's just take a look at Rwanda today. Of course, tomorrow, the reason why I'm doing this is because tomorrow is that date in history, April 7th, 1994.
Correct.
But the day will be commemorated with prayer vigils in Rwanda. Anything of significance that we need to know about or should be looking at, paying attention to, maybe here locally, or if not locally, what is happening in Rwanda since we have the capability now to reach out across the globe and contact and connect with, people around the world? Anything we should be looking at?
Absolutely. I say we should really examine the dangerous and catastrophic role that U.S. imperial designs play in terms of its impact on ordinary people in Africa. Because the U.S. was sold on this idea to tolerate the invasion by General Museveni, the idea that French neocolonialism in Rwanda could then be displaced by U.S. English-speaking neocolonialism via Uganda. And as a result, the population of Rwanda, both Tutsi and Hutus, paid the ultimate cost. Hundreds of thousands of Africans were killed as a result of this U.S. / Uganda. And when I say Uganda, not the people of Uganda, mm-hmm. but the Ugandan dictator. For the people of Uganda love their neighbors in Rwanda, just like they love all other East Africans. And as a Ugandan, I personally feel bad that my country played a role in that calamity. And I think Americans similarly should also feel bad by the roles that their government played in that calamity. That is why it's important for us to know U.S. imperial machinations, not only in Africa, but around the world, yes, and the consequences that ordinary people pay the price.
Ordinary people pay the price, folks like you and me and our listeners. Milton, what's the name of your latest book, and where can people find out about the work that you're doing? I know Black Star News, you're going to say that, of course. But tell us the name of your latest book, and how can people get in touch and keep abreast of what you're doing?
Thank you so much for that. The website, of course, is blackstarnews.com. The book is Manufacturing Hate, How Africa Was Demonized in Western Media. It's available from Kendall Hunt, K-E-N-D-A-L-L-H-U-N-T, hunt.com. That is the publisher's website. It's also available on Amazon. The book, the corporate media did not feel to review the book, but fortunately, many other outlets have reviewed it, including WBAI, including fair.org, so I appreciate that as well. I appreciate that Mimi Rosenberg interviewed me on her show, our program, about this book. And in that book, I also discuss the demonization of the Hutu population in Rwanda in a chapter in order to set up the war that ultimately was launched. So thank you so much for giving me that opportunity.
Oh, without a doubt.
To have this conversation with you today.
For sure. Milton Alamadi, thank you so much for being on the program today. Looking back in history, that's paramount in what I try to do over these airways when I have the opportunity to bring you this program or anything else that I happen to. Milton Alamadi, thank you so much again.
Thank you for your time, and thank you for even having me years ago before I had my own show, because that gave me the practice that I needed. So much appreciation, brother.
Milton
Alamadi. Your family.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much. Milton Alamadi over WBAI's Living for the City, and I'm delighted, I must say, I am delighted to have had Milton on today. He's a producer, a producer on this radio station. And last week, having Dr. Harriet Fraud on, we were talking about, well, it's part of the second part of the show, but we were talking about patriarchy. Did you get a chance to listen to that? Well, you can listen to it right now through the archives. In fact, you can listen to the program, this very program today, at about 12:15. Just go to our website, wbai.org, and look up past programs. That is made available to listeners just like you. Well, as we prepare to conclude with our outgoing theme, family, I just would like to say one more time, before we have to move on, is to become a member of WBAI by calling our pledge line right now at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. That's the number to call. Become a member of this radio station. It is commercially free and listener sponsored. And people all around this tri-state area, in New York, in Sullivan County, in Delaware County, in Greene County, up there in Albany, far afield. And we broadcast in parts of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, Delaware, and Bucks County. Let's hear from you. Oh, that theme is good. I love that theme song. It's called Family, Jennifer Hudson. There we go. We are a family. Down in New Jersey, I mentioned Ocean County, Middlesex, Union, Morris County, Sussex, and Hunterdon County. Call our pledge line right now at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. 2950. Support Living for the City. Support radio station WBAI. 212-209-2950. Don't delay. It's only going to take you 3 minutes and you will have made your contribution. Thank you so much. I want to thank Paul DiRienzo for, as I said, being quite adept covering for me while I'm away. I appreciate that. Thank you very much, Paul. And thank WBAI. Thank our listeners. Oh, my goodness. Our listener, supporter, subscribers. That's you. That's right. That's you. You can do it. You have done it since 1960. Listener sponsored and commercial free. What a radio station we have. What a radio station. Make a contribution right now. 212-209-2950. Remember to surround yourself with people who respect and treat you well. That's right. I'm Michael G. Haskins. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
And you are listening to WBAI New York. We're coming up to the 12 o'clock hour, just a few minutes. And then we're going to be listening to some special programming with everybody's favorite, Gary Knoll. Stand by.
Hi, this is David Amer. Listening to WBAI New York. 99.5 on your FM dial and keep on listening.
Hi there. For WBAI New York, I'm Linda Perry. As we move through April, I want to take a moment to thank new WBAI buddies, new BAI buddies who joined WBAI during Women's History Month. Jane Gennaro from the Upper West Side says, thanks for the beautiful programming for Women's History Month. Lucia Calamnaro is also a new buddy. She's from Boston, Massachusetts. She says, I can't choose a favorite program. You're a treasure, WBAI. So grateful you are here. Thank you also to Michelle Babian from Yonkers, a new buddy whose message is peace with the earth. Victoria from Terrytowns appreciates all WBAI shows. Jean-Louis from Long Island loves Gary Knoll's show. Steve Stansel from Brooklyn, New York is now a buddy at $20 a month. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Sandra Lynn, who appreciates WBAI's new morning show, What's Going On? She's a new buddy, and so is Francois from Brooklyn. Also from Brooklyn, Ben Yee is a new BAI buddy. His favorite show is from Margaret Flowers, Clearing the Fog. Ellis Landy from the Bronx says she loves WBAI. She's a new WBAI buddy, and so is Sandra from Ringwood, New Jersey. Her favorite show is Code Pink Radio. Ken from Harlem is also a new WBAI buddy. He's contributing $50 a month. He's from Harlem. His favorite show is Imhotep Gary Bird's Radio GBE, Gloria J. Brown Marshall with Law of the Land, and other shows. He says there's so many he loves. Lloyd from Brooklyn is a new WBAI buddy. Thank you so much, Lloyd. Amma from Flushing is also a new buddy. Thank you. So is Thomasina in New Jersey and Betty Garland, who likes Vantage Point and Mansion for a Rat. Thank you. Pedro Chinnery from Suffern, New York is also a new WBAI buddy, showing the reach of WBAI. He appreciates equal rights and justice. Lori from the Upper West Side likes Building Bridges. Mike from Brooklyn is a new buddy in the name of Con Sabor Latino. Brenda from Montclair, New Jersey appreciates any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Thanks also to John from Chicago, a $100 buddy. Thank you so much to all of our new WBAI buddies, our monthly contributors, large and small and small and large. We so appreciate you and your continued support. If you'd like to become a WBAI buddy, just go to our website, WBAI.org, and click Buddy. or call 212-209-2950. And remember to tell us what your favorite show is. I don't have time to list all the new buddies right here and right now, but know that we thank you. Thank you so very much for your support.
And thank you, Linda, for your hard work. That's what's really going on here. And remember, 212-209-2950 to become a sustaining member of BAI Buddy.